Visionary roboticist Sebastian Thrun, experimental artist and philosopher Jonathan Keats, cyborg beetle master. But you never thought you'd be called the beetle master, did you? I made it up myself. Michelle Maharbiz, and the man behind the flying car, Paul Moeller, as well as the expert bioengineer among this group, Christina Smolke. These big thinkers are ready to defy reality and debunk all of your expectations, so get ready to have your mind blown. After the presentations, we'll also have a 15-minute group discussion followed by questions from you guys, the audience, so start thinking about your hard-hitting asks now and be ready to ask them in a little bit. Hopefully this will become your new favorite panel format here at Inform and ours too. And if you're not already a member of Inform, I would really, really encourage you to join our ranks. It's only $6 a month, and we honestly can't do it without you. It's really helpful to have every member, and we value your feedback and opinion. So join us if you haven't already. A few upcoming panels on August 11th. Come and hear the rants and raves of four of San Francisco's funniest up-and-coming comics at Comedy Spanx Politics. The truth never hurts so good. Also, on September 21st, author Jonathan Safran Foer is going to be here sharing his thoughts on eating animals and the ethics of our appetites. And one quick opening reminder. So don't forget to turn off your cell phones. I know everybody's got one. If you don't have a cell phone, raise your hand. No? No? Oh, good. Good for you. You're probably very liberating. So turn off your cell phones if you have them. And if you'd like to live tweet about our event during the program, you can go ahead and use hashtag InforumSF. Now let's get the jaw-dropping started. I'd like to present to you our first speaker, Jeffrey Ma. Jeff is a former member of the scandalous MIT Blackjack team and the inspiration for the movie 21, which I'm sure you've all seen. It's very, very good. He's also the author of The House Advantage, which applies to card-counting lessons that will help you win big in business. Please welcome Mr. Jeffrey Ma.
This is like a new thing for me, this time limit thing, so I'm a little nervous. Just kidding. That wasn't a good sound from the presentation. What do we got going on here? This isn't counting against my time, is it? It doesn't start yet, does it? Are we good? Oh, okay. This does look like one of my slides. No, we skipped the first slide. It's okay. Yeah, there we go. Kind of kills the first joke if we don't see the first slide. Okay, ready? Clock starts now. So how many of you guys have seen 21? Pretty good. So you guys know what I like to call the greatest bit of Hollywood magic is how you turn an average-looking Asian-American male into a dashing British white guy, which is what you see there. Yes, I was the inspiration for Jim Sturgess's character, the main character in 21, and I like to also start with some stories that weren't in the book, and since I'm on a time limit, I'm only going to tell you one. It comes from the opening night of the Bellagio. So opening night of every casino, there's three types of people there. There's card counters like myself, because for us, this was like our emerging markets. We would go there. It was like the, you know, like going to a third world country or going to a new region. For us, a new casino opening. The second type of person are celebrities. Celebrities would always be at opening of casinos because they want to see and be seen. Anyone guess the third kind? Usually it takes a little while in a crowd like this because everyone's kind of, you know, professional, whatnot. I was at a real estate conference in Orange. What's that? Hooker, there we go. Stand up. Stand up so everyone sees who got it correctly. At corporate events, they call that a career-limiting maneuver. But I was in an opening of I was at a real estate conference in Orange County, and no sooner had the words come out of my mouth than a woman from the back row screamed, "Hookers!" So, card counters, celebrities, and prostitutes, and I was at the opening weekend of the Bellagio, and I had the pleasure of playing blackjack with Kevin Costner. And every hand he lost, well, so he had his whole posse around with him, and if he were a rapper, it would have been his posse. But since it was Kevin Costner, it was just his group of goofy friends. And every hand he lost, his friends would look at him and go, "God, this is like Waterworld all over again." So we all have defining moments in our lives. And for me, the most important lesson I learned from the blackjack days, and so, you know, the story of my life was that I was a card counter for the better part of 7 years and used math to beat the casinos, and I'll kind of get into that a little bit later. But basically, I think about the most important lesson that I've ever learned, and it comes from a casino, from Caesar's Palace. When I was 22 years old, and using math to beat the casino, rolled up to the table and bet two hands of $10,000 because that's what the math told me to do. This is completely objective stuff, no subjectivity involved. On the first hand, I got 11. On the second hand, I got a pair of nines. The dealer had a six up. So any of you guys that play blackjack know that there's only one thing to do. There's something called basic strategy, which tells you what to do in every situation. It's been played out, simulated on computers, you know, thousands of times, and they know what the right thing to do is. So 11 against a 6 is something you double down. So I put another $10,000 down, and I got a 7 on that to make 18. The pair of 9s against the 6, you actually split, which means I need to put another $10,000 down. I do. I get a 2 on the first 9 to make 11. So what do I got to do? I got to double down again. I do. I put another $10,000 down. I get an 8 on that to make 19. And on the last 9, I get a 10 to make 19. So all total, how much money do I have on the table? $50,000. Very good. The dealer has a 6, flips a 5 to make 11, and then gets a 10 to make 21. I lose $50,000. This woman behind me shrieks, "Oh my God, that's my entire mortgage." And I want to turn around and go, "Where the hell do you live?" Because that's like a cardboard box in the Tenderloin here. But again, I'm using math to beat the casino. So there's no subjectivity involved. It's all math, right? And I sit down and I bet 3 hands of $10,000 now because that's what the math tells me to do. On the first one, I get a 9 and the dealer has a 5 up. So basic strategy, again, would tell me that I need to double that. I do. I get a 10 to make 19. And then the ace 4 is also a double down hand. Okay, so I put another $10,000 down and I get a 4 to make 19. And the dealer has a 5 up. So this is one of those moments that you wonder, how in the world did I ever get here? And I kind of flash back. So for 7 years, I was a professional card counter. Okay, during that whole time, I graduated from MIT in 1994. I worked on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. I helped start this thing called the Internet. That's what it looks like. I didn't actually start it. Al Gore started it. We can actually say now that Al Gore invented 2 things, one good, one bad. He invented the Internet, certainly good, and improves our productivity, the whole thing. Invented global warming, bad. So at least he's done one good, one bad thing. But during this whole time, you know, I helped start 3 different companies that I sold all 3 of them. The last one, Citizen Sports, I just sold to Yahoo about 3 months ago. But the whole time behind this, I was a professional card counter. So the thing that people always say is, what does it mean that you're a professional blackjack player? The first thing they ask is, isn't that illegal? It's actually been tried up to the highest level of the Supreme Court. It's 100% legal. It's just using your brain to beat a game. The second thing people say is, are you banned from Vegas? And believe it or not, there's not someone who waits for me the jetway of McCarran Airport when I show up and says, sorry, Mr. Ma, you have to go home. I'm just not allowed to play blackjack there. And I could tell you a really funny story about this, but I can't because I don't have time. So you'll have to buy my book, which is on sale in the back. And they say, remind me never to play poker with you. And this statement actually, while interesting, it kind of is very indicative of the difference between blackjack and poker. Poker is a game of incomplete information. It's like trying to use numbers to forecast the market. You don't know how people are going to act. People may act irrationally, and you're stuck. Because even though your numbers are perfect, they act irrationally, and your strategy won't work. But blackjack, you play only against the casino, only against the dealer, and you know at all times how they're going to act. So why blackjack? Well, blackjack is the only game in the casino that's subject to something called conditional probability, meaning what you see impacts what you're going to see. If you look at roulette, right, the roulette wheel has this beautiful magical sign above it, which shows the results of the last 20 spins. And really intelligent people, I'm sure nobody in this room, but really intelligent people will wander up to a table, see 7 reds in a row, and all of a sudden think that black's going to come up and will bet on black. But there's obviously a fallacy in that. It's called the gambler's fallacy. The same thing is true of craps, right? People believe that, like, if there's 2 11s in a row, they should bet the yo, which is a bet on the 11, because there's a lot of 11s in that dice. Well, actually, there's probably just as many 11s as there are in any other dice, not very many. But blackjack is different. If I take all 4 aces out of a deck of cards and hand you that deck of cards, what do you think the chance of you dealing yourself blackjack are? 0. Okay? And the reason that there's fish, and do you guys ever get this? Fish have no memory. Elephants have a really good memory. There you go. So what is counting cards? Counting cards is basically just using data from the past to predict the future. There was a guy by the name of Ed Thorpe, who at the time was at UCLA, and what he found is that he did basic simulations, and again, there's this long, elaborate story about this that I usually tell, but you'll have to get the book. What he found is that when there's a lot of high cards left in the deck, it's in the dealer's favor. It's in the player's favor. When there's a lot of low cards left in the deck, it's in the player's favor. And all that card counting is tracking the high cards to low cards you've seen so that you know what high cards to low cards you're going to see. Okay, it's very simple. And that's one of the reasons that made me realize that I wanted to write my book, The House Advantage, because I realized that that was so quintessential to what was going on in the world right now, which is that the best way to predict the future is to look at the past. And so many companies are harnessing that kind of stuff, but so many aren't. So many industries like medicine and you know, media, they need to start looking better at ways to use the past to predict the future. People think card counting is magic when in reality it's not. So that's why I started writing The House Advantage, because I wanted to really show people and get to people, give people a way to think about making better decisions. So we're going to skip over this. That's me as a dealer in the movie. It really was. I have three lines. I'm really good. And just talk quickly about what did card counting teach me about making better decisions. So the first thing is realize decisions are everywhere. A decision to maintain status quo is still a decision. And that really comes from the idea of why people make mistakes in blackjack. Often they make mistakes because they stand on things they shouldn't stand on, and they think that they kind of are, they're favoring inactivity over activity. The second thing that I always talk about, and I'm going to have to go through these really quickly because we don't have very much time, but evaluating decisions from a true zero frame of reference. This has to do with the cognitive bias called loss aversion. And it's oftentimes why people make bad decisions, but I illustrate in my book a lot of how that plays itself out in blackjack. When you make a decision, try to make that decision with the idea that you get to make it a million times, not just once, because the gravity of the situation is hard when it's just once, but a millions of times you think, gosh, I'll be able to let the law of large numbers even out. And then don't confuse the outcome with the decision. Just because you make a bad decision doesn't necessarily, just because you have a bad outcome doesn't mean you made a bad decision. Okay? And finally, to illustrate all these points quickly, going back to my big lesson. Okay, I had lost $50,000. Oh, that ruined the whole thing. Oh, all right. Well, so the dealer flipped a 10 to make 15 and then got a 6 to make 21. So I lost $50,000. Okay, and I remember this. I walked up to my room at Caesar's Palace, collapsed down on the floor, stared up at the ceiling, wondered why is there a mirror up there. But then once I got over that, I was 22 years old. Well, I didn't know why there was a mirror up there. Once I got over that, I realized all those different lessons that I had just told you about not confusing the outcome with the decision, not being loss averse, wanting to take the same risks, evaluating what I had done versus what had happened. And I realized that I'd done everything right and that my strategy worked. So I went back downstairs and I kept playing and I won back my original $100,000 and then I ended up winning $70,000 for the weekend. And that all became sort of my defining moment and why I believe so much in, you know, what I call in my book, the religion of statistics. So thank you guys.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That was great. And Jeff will be signing books afterwards, so I highly recommend everyone get one if you want to hear more of those amazing stories. Now we have Professor Sebastian Thrun, robotics master and director of Stanford's Artificial Intelligence Lab. He and his self-driving car, Stanley, won the 2005 DARPA Grand Challenge. So please join me in welcoming Professor Thrun.
Thank you. Thank you. I also work at a little search company that Peter is affiliated with called, what was it again, man? Google.
Ah,
thank you. I'll talk about something entirely different, something that affects all of us. Hopefully, most of you don't play and gamble $100,000 away in casinos. That is transportation. In fact, Paul will talk about this later this afternoon. Specifically, cars. Cars affect all of us in San Francisco. Most of you own cars. What are your cars doing right now? Sitting around doing nothing, taking away space, right? Cars are as inefficient as, I would argue, TV news and music and newspapers and personal communication was before the advent of the internet. In fact, just one statistic. This is the life of young people and the cause of death for people aged 15 to 24, where cars outrank any other cause of death. Here's some examples of how this looks like. I'm sure some of you have experienced situations like those. Cars are also inefficient when it comes to utilization. Cars are being used an average of 3% of their lifetime. So being parked in San Francisco, 97% of the lifetime. Just imagine if you could cut the number of cars in half, what this would do to our city and to your life and to your living expenses. And they're inefficient in just so many ways. This is a picture of a highway at peak capacity, which is the time when the highway functions the best. It gives you about 2,000 vehicles per lane per hour, one car every 2 seconds. And in these situations, a fully packed highway is only 8% occupied. That is, if you take a picture from the air and look at the pavement pixels you can still see between those cars, only 8% is covered by cars and 92% is empty pavement. So a full highway is empty, which raises the question, can we invent technology that packs us closer together? It's a relevant question because in many population-dense areas like San Francisco and Los Angeles and the Washington Beltway, we are in many ways beyond what's reasonable. We have these enormous traffic jams that take forever, and we are increasing highway utilization by 3% per year in this country, and we're not building any new highways. It's a disaster. They're getting worse and worse by the year. So at Stanford and now to some extent at Google, we're really asking questions, can we fundamentally alter this and invent new technologies to really assist us to be more effective with resources like time and human life and energy and so on in this space? As Aaron mentioned, I was involved and gave a talk actually here a couple of years ago. Can we turn down the sound, please? Thank you, Eric. On something called the DARPA Grand Challenge. This was a government-sponsored robotic robot race where autonomous cars were asked to drive more than 100 miles through punishing, unrehearsed desert terrain. Here's a car by a university called Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we built a Volkswagen Touareg that's now exhibited in the Smithsonian Museum of National American History that actually drove by itself about 142 miles completely driverless and not just remote controlled. No, the intelligence was in the car itself. So it was able to handle all situations by itself. If you were a passenger of this car, you could sit down and sleep, or more importantly, you could text guilt-free, right? I mean, we all text during driving. We could do it without guilt. This led to a race fairly recently called the DARPA Urban Challenge, where cars were asked to drive in traffic. This is a situation from that challenge. You see our car over here. All the other cars are actually manned. There's stunt drivers in there that are very courageous men and women. And here's our car having to take a left turn into a relatively dense traffic situation. And doing so, I would say, quite confidently. And then staying on the lane all by itself. So this is artificial intelligence of the 21st century. This is really not remotely controlled. It's really autonomous, as we call it. More recently, these cars have been driving, possibly in your neighborhood. Thanks for participating in our scientific experiments. Usually they have people behind the wheel that provide safety, always. But they're able to drive on parking lots and yield to pedestrians, as you can see over here. Now, the innovation behind all this is a new set of technologies that I can only talk about very briefly that really enable cars to be smart about the environment. Okay? Planes do this already, but cars haven't been doing this in the past. Here's a sample data point of this technology, if it plays. Please play. This is called a laser camera. A laser camera is just like a normal camera. Thank you. It takes views at 360 degrees, turns out a whole panoramic view. And it also measures the range of things, how far things are away. It has a technology that measures how long the light it takes to bounce off an object. In doing so, you can actually find vertical things that stick out that are candidates for obstacles. The car takes this data, thousands of times per second. That was a wonderful animation here. Doesn't play. And is able to produce very detailed environmental models at a level of precision and accuracy that is unparalleled by human perception, as shown over here. It then analyzes the data for the occurrence of other traffic participants. If this video plays, please play. Okay, it doesn't play. You would have seen a sequence where the car is able to pick up other cars in traffic and analyze their motion. And if this one plays, these cars are also able, in fact, much more competently than most PowerPoint PCs, to deal with other traffic like this intersection situation where you can see three other cars waiting, and our car confidently drives in, and because it's German programmed, it takes the right away from everybody else and just dashes ahead. Here's an example. I wonder what's happening to these videos. Can we try to play them manually? Is there any way to just click on them? Where our car is asked to do a fairly complicated maneuver to park itself in this spot over here. And if the video played, you'd see it backing up into the spot over here, right next to two people's cars that don't know about our experiments. And then it pulls itself out and just drives there. Let's see what happens next. This is a human-driven maneuver, which my students showed me, and I liked it. I figured for San Francisco, that's just the right way to park. Okay, so I tried this out. I parked my car. I went to a restaurant and came back, and I couldn't unpark it. So there's a little gap here. So I showed this to my students and challenged them to do the same using computer software. And this is completely self-driven. We're doing it backwards. This specific car doesn't flip nicely forwards because the engine's in the front. But you can see it doing its job by itself. Now, I'm showing you this because I believe there's a whole set of technologies that we're not using today that could really ease our life. Like, you are slightly tipsy after an evening at the bar, okay? Get into your self-driving car, and no need to bring a spouse anymore. Wouldn't that be cool? Okay? You want to drive up to Tahoe? Well, maybe your car is slow, but it has a big bed inside, and just get inside, sleep a little bit, and when you wake up fresh, you're at the lake. I think there's many opportunities for this technology for all of us that I'm really excited about. When I give this talk, I often ask about what's the challenge for society, and I believe the following things are absolutely achievable. I'm happy to comment on those later because I'm mostly out of time. I think it's completely conceivable to cut accidents in half. We have about 40,000 people that die every year in the United States because of traffic accidents, and nearly every accident is caused by human error, by us on our phone, texting, or flipping the channel on the radio, or just not paying attention at all. Okay? More than 2 million accidents in total. We lose 1.2 million people every year in the world. Just to give you a perspective, every year the losses in the United States is as big as about 10 or 11 9/11s. So we get all worried about terrorist attacks, rightfully so, but what the life we pay with this technology every single day is much, much larger. Okay? I believe it's completely feasible to cut the number of cars in half. And I know you in San Francisco know this because most of you just use public transportation. But even in places like Iowa and Kansas and Texas, we can do this because the cars are parked all the time. What if the cars just came up to you if you needed one? You could go to your phone and say, car please, and a car pulls around the corner and you could use it. I argued we could double highway capacity quite easily. If we did so, we would go from 8% occupancy to 16%, so the highway would still be 84% occupied. So I'm thinking of a future where cars can drive very closely together under computer control. We can cut commute time in half. A lot of commute time right now is just waiting in traffic, especially in the East Bay, I guess. And it is actually conceivable to cut energy in half. And the reason is a number of reasons. One is that by driving far away, we miss out on opportunity to exploit wind drag to reduce energy consumption. By making cars safe, we can make them lighter. A lot of car weight is dedicated to safety equipment. And I think we can really reduce car use in total by technologies like this one over here. So I see the zero back there. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Jonathan Keats, conceptual artist and experimental philosopher, who has done everything from attempt to genetically engineer God and customize the metric system to apply string theory to real estate. Tonight, we all get to participate in his thought experiment. So join me in welcoming Jonathan Keats.
According to the publicity for this event, I once attempted to genetically engineer God, and that's true. I've also copyrighted my mind, designed a voting booth for the 2008 election based on Ouija technology, and I have even exhibited extraterrestrial abstract artwork at the Judah L. Magnus Museum. But I'm not going to talk to you about any of those things tonight. Instead, I'm going to talk about yet another one of the projects that I have been involved with over the past 3 or 4 years. Perhaps outlandish as well. I wanted to make movies. Now, I realize that a lot of other people had made movies before me. For example, you have Thomas Edison and you have James Cameron. But I wanted to make movies for a different audience than they had pursued. I figure that humans are plentiful on this planet, but there are a lot more various other organisms. In particular, there are a lot of plants. Now, plants are, as I saw when I thought about it, an ideal audience for experiencing movies. They're able to perform photosynthesis, and what are movies really other than light? So my idea was to simply project the movie right onto the foliage of the plant, and the plant would be able to experience the film, would be able to, in a sense, even digest it, to metabolize it, to be able to have a more intense experience than even we can have. But the problem was that I didn't know what plants would like, what they might enjoy watching. So I figured that I would kind of look through the history of filmmaking, think about what other filmmakers had done. And it turns out that a lot of them started out in a realm that seems to be appealing to many people, pornography. So I figured that I would make pornography for plants. And that was not such a difficult thing to do. Plants, obviously, they do reproduce, and they do so by the agency of honeybees. So I figured that what I could do is I could just film bees pollinating flowers, and then taking that footage, I would be able to make pornography for houseplants. So, of course, a plant is not the same as a human. A plant experiences the world in a slightly different way. For example, plants don't have eyes. So it isn't like a plant would see what you're seeing on the screen. In fact, what a plant would experience as bees were hovering overhead in a titillating kind of a way would be sort of a shadow play, as you can see here from one of the frames from the Porn for Plants that I created. And so, you know, once I had this idea, that the bee, by the way, is here for those of you who are not plants. So once I had this, I immediately found that there were many venues that were interested in showing it. I started out by opening what I believe to be the world's first porn theater for houseplants in the town of Chico, California, at 1078 Gallery. And I followed this up about a year later by opening a second one that was at the at Montana State University. And in the case of this first one, which you can see a still from, those are rhododendrons, 90 of them, all experiencing this porn together. In the case of the plants in Montana, I showed the pornography to zinnias instead. And all of this seemed to be going quite well. I was, as far as I could tell, the foremost pornographer for plants on the planet. But it seemed to me that it also was somewhat limiting. You don't want to get too pigeonholed into one or another genre, as people have done. I decided I wanted to think about something that would appeal more broadly to the plant kingdom than just porn. Because, of course, there are many plants that don't reproduce sexually, like ferns, for example. And ferns, I'm sure, would find this material interesting in an academic sort of way, but I just doubt that there would be any sort of a titillation involved, and therefore it would not operate as pornography in the way intended. So I started to think about, well, what is universal in terms of what would be interesting to a plant? And, of course, plants, they have roots. They're in the ground, they're stuck in one place. So I figured that maybe what they would find interesting would be travel. So what I started doing a couple years ago was filming travel documentaries for plants. And in this case, I was making movies to be shown in New York City, in Chelsea at the AC Institute, filming skies in Italy. I spent 2 months doing so, and there were some very nice skies. I figured that these skies would be the right sort of material for a plant, because that really is what matters. The Eiffel Tower, which I believe I just showed you, wouldn't really register for a plant. The sky, on the other hand, that is exciting. So I decided that I would show skies in Italy to houseplants in New York. And once again, I didn't want to anthropomorphize the plants. I wanted to be true to how a plant experiences the world. And of course, a plant experiences the sky, clouds, for example, in a way that is very different from the way that a plant experiences honeybees and insects, because the clouds are a lot farther away. And as we previously covered, they don't have eyes, plants, any of them, as far as I know. So I decided that what I would need to do would be to, in some way, create the effect of distance, or in other words, diffusion of the light from the sky, such that the plants would be able to experience these Italian skies in New York in a way that would be meaningful to them as plants. And so I opened up the theater, and what I did was I created a scrim, and I projected through the scrim onto the plants. As you can see, it's a rather motley group of houseplants. These actually are plants that usually get rented out for conventions, and so this was somewhat of a novel experience for them. So I got 8 of them, and I projected through a scrim onto the foliage for about, well, a month and a half, and none of them died. So I take that to be a success as well. And I guess that some people might think that this is absurd. And I would have to agree. It is absurd, but the absurdity to me is really what I'm after as, well, as an experimental philosopher working within the realm of art, because art, the art world tends to be confused enough that it kind of allows you to do whatever you want. What I'm interested in are thought experiments, the way in which in philosophy traditionally you would take a situation that was unlike what we ordinarily encounter, a counterfactual situation, an alternative world, and you use that as a way to look back upon the world in which we live. And that really is what I'm doing, only I'm doing it a little bit more literally than on paper. I'm actually trying to set up thought experiments out in the world. So to create an absurd scenario, some sort of situation that is outside of our everyday experience, yet has components that are absolutely familiar to us, and to use that as a way to, I suppose, to deracinate, to defamiliarize us. So, of course, we always are watching movies, and we see a lot on the screen, but we usually don't see plants doing that. And when you see a plant watching a movie, maybe it gets you to start thinking about how you get from this media experiences that are not maybe entirely authentic. In other words, most of the world that we experience is mediated. We see it on various screens. And in the case of this particular thought experiment, I wanted to encourage people to step outside of themselves, to do so myself, first of all, and to watch plants watching movies as a way of reflecting on how it is that we encounter the world in this second, third, and fourth screen mediated sort of way. That is, alas, all that I have time to speak with you about tonight. So no genetically engineering God, but the genetically engineering of God was in the same spirit as was copyrighting my own mind. Everything that I do is, as I say, a thought experiment, and really is an attempt at trying to make sense of the world in my own absurd way. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Now we'll bring up Christina Smolke, Assistant Professor of Bioengineering at Stanford and the winner of the 2009 World Technology Award for Biotechnology. Christina is making strides in synthetic immunotherapy as it relates to cancer treatment. Here to tell us more about her biotech breakthroughs is Christina Smolke.
So I'll focus my comments today on providing you with an introduction to the emerging field of synthetic biology. There are many diseases that we currently don't have effective treatments for. What I'm showing you here is an image of a patient that has a glioma or a brain tumor. Now, as many of you may know, this is a very devastating disease, and the current treatment strategies, which are based on radiation, chemical treatment, or even surgery, are not effective at treating this type of disease. And so the prognosis for patients who have this disease is quite poor. So we need to do better, and we need to be able to develop more effective treatment strategies. Now, Hollywood actually presented us with an inspiration for a type of treatment strategy for this and other types of diseases, and this was presented over 45 years ago. Some of you may be familiar with this movie, The Fantastic Voyage. Essentially, what happens is that scientists have made a sort of shrinking machine so that you can load a group of physicians and scientists into a submarine and then use this machine to shrink the submarine down to sort of a micron size and then inject it into the patient. This submarine can then be navigated to different parts of the body. And in this movie, the physicians were basically targeting and destroying a blood clot that was in the brain of a patient. Now, 45 years later, physicists still have not given us shrinking rays. And so we don't basically have this technology on hand. Another important capability for our society is manufacturing, the ability to manufacture chemicals and different materials. And oftentimes our strategies are based in synthetic methods that we have developed as humans. But if we look at the natural world around us, we can find inspiration for the complexity and diversity of chemicals and materials that biology can make naturally. And so what I'm showing you here on my slide are images of trees that can make anti-cancer compounds, plants that can make pain relief medicine, organisms like spiders that can weave materials with tensile and sort of strength properties that we can't even approach as humans. Microorganisms and bacteria that can produce alternative fuel sources like butanol. And finally, trees that can make materials like rubber. And so this sort of highlights the diversity that we can see in nature. But you can imagine that actually harvesting these materials and chemicals from these sources is not scalable, right? It would be very hard to sort of direct spiders to sort of make materials that we would want them to make in a very scalable and cheap way. Also, growing up fields of trees becomes very costly. We have time costs and also the cost of extracting the material. And so what many researchers have been interested in looking at is taking those capabilities, those basic capabilities, and moving them into small bacteria that would be easy to grow and scale, and giving them the ability to basically make those types of chemicals and materials for humans and populations. What I just presented to you were two compelling applications that would fall into the realm of biotechnology. What's interesting about biotechnology as a technology sector is that it's been driven, the investments in biotechnology have been driven by these types of stories, these compelling stories around applications. Now, this is a very different model than other technology sectors, the way that other technology sectors have developed, like in the electronics field, where what's happened in those fields is that there's been a very large upfront investment in the tools, the technology platforms that will then support broadly being able to approach and tackle many different type of applications. And so biotechnology has developed sort of outside of this type of model where, again, we've sort of focused on application by application on a point-by-point basis and not really invested in developing out the tool base. And that's really what the focus of synthetic biology is. So if we think about this, and think, again, very broadly about how we might approach engineering a complex system, I'm showing you here a picture of the Mars rover. And so what we have here is a challenge in which engineers want to develop a complex system that will be put into an environment where we would like this system to be able to respond and detect signals that it's receiving from its environment and be able to process those signals and make decisions and respond to the signals that it's actually receiving. And so to do this, engineers designing this type of system basically draw upon a wide variety of different types of foundational tools and capabilities that they can sort of take from the shelf and sort of piece together into this complex system. And so you can imagine what you'd like to have are different types of sensors to allow the system to respond to its environment. You'd also like to have actuators, which allows it to make decisions. And finally, the most important part is the circuitry, which connects the two, allows the system to do signal processing, dynamic control, remote control, and memory, some of what we heard about in the previous talks today. What we want to do is develop the same types of tools when we think about engineering biological systems. So if we think about wanting to engineer a cell to go into a complex environment where we'll be receiving signals and responding to those signals, we need to develop and the same type of capabilities, sensors, actuators, and also circuitry that we can sort of plug and play into the cell and allow and basically redirect and program its behavior. And so over 35 years ago in biotechnology, we had our first tools revolution. This was led to the first generation of biotechnology. And so within this tools revolution, we basically developed out the tools that allow us to cut and paste pieces of DNA together, which would encode genetic information and genetic functions. We also developed tools that allowed us to amplify and make very small changes to that DNA. And finally, with sequencing, tools that allowed us to read out the code. Now, over 35 years later, what you see within synthetic biology is basically the next generation of tools being developed. So now we see researchers developing tools that allow for sort of fabrication platforms, being able to synthesize very large pieces of DNA, entire genomes, in fact. You see researchers developing abstraction tools, which allow us to sort of abstract away from the details and put many components together into complex systems, and standardization, standardizing the interfaces between pieces, allowing them to work together in a plug-and-play fashion more reliably. Another type of tool that's been being developed in the field is that of device design. And so what I'm showing you here is an example of a particular type of device. This is a device that we would like to act as a sort of molecular computer. So what you see here is a device, and this is a very abstract view, where it's going to receive a particular type of input from the environment. It's going to do some sort of information processing or computation on that input, and ultimately it's going to release an output or redirect the function of the cell. A tool, then, platform, would allow us to take this device design and abstract it into its pieces so that we can abstract away the simpler component functions of sensing, actuation, information transmission, standardize the interfaces between them, and then ultimately what we can do is sort of nail this down into the details of the actual genetic and molecular components that will encode those functions. If I take an example here and highlight, if we just take one example of these genetic pieces, what you see here is an example of some of the devices that we've been able to build. So you can see if we take one sensor, one transmitter, one actuator, we could develop an example that relates sort of input A to the output and giving us a type of buffer gate. We can reuse these parts, swap out the transmitter, now have a device that performs the inverse computation on this sort of system, so now acts as an inverter gate. And finally, what you see is that we have the capability to swap in different sensors and reuse this device design so we can respond to many, many different types of inputs. We can take this one step further and extend this type of device platform such that now you can couple more than one sensor, more than one transmitter, and as you see here, we can scale the sort of single input gates that you see to sort of multi-input gates, showing you here a two-input gate as a NAND gate by just sort of extending on this computation. So what we have now is the ability to sort of scale and develop scalable logic and higher-order molecular computers that we can actually put into cells and have them sort of implement certain functions that we would like to see. So how does this type of technology actually affect the applications that I showed you in the first part of my talk? And so if we return to the example of the glioma patient, what we described is we wanted to have a more intelligent type of therapy, a therapy that actually had a sort of intelligence associated with it, where it can go into the body, direct itself and target itself to a certain area of the body, and then know when it was in the microenvironment of the disease cells and execute then the therapeutic effect. Well, instead of developing a shrinking ray, what synthetic biology can do for us is actually allow us to reprogram the behavior of cells within the body. And so in this case, what we're looking at is actually developing more advanced types of cell-based therapies. And what we're actually looking at doing is taking immune cells from the patient's body and endowing them with functions that would allow them to both recognize where the disease cells are and then implement a very effective immune response to remove the cancer or other disease cells from the body. And essentially what we're doing here is actually implementing those types of molecular computers in these cells to allow them to do that type of information processing. So just to sort of zoom in a little bit more on the details here, what we have is that molecular computer that I showed you before. In the absence of a drug molecule or in the absence of a signal that the clinician might be giving to the patient, it will basically exhibit no immune response, not result in activation and proliferation of the cells. When the clinician adds the drugs, we'd expect for the computer to process that input and then turn on activation of the immune system and get a very effective response. Because we've developed out the technology platform that I showed you, we could rapidly prototype this system and move it very quickly into in vivo applications, as you see here with the mouse model. Now, the implications of the slide is that the T cells, these are immune cells, are actually expressing or make a light protein. And so when you see the little red circles there, that's the light that's being emitted by the T cells. And so what you can see if you look on the right-hand panel is essentially that the cells with our molecular computer do exhibit a response and are regulating the immune system response in response to the signals of interest. And if we look even, we return to the sort of manufacturing examples, what we have here is sort of state-of-the-art in the field of, as of a couple years ago, with that it would take several tens of millions of dollars of investment to basically engineer one microorganism to produce one drug compound, in this case to treat malaria. This is not a sort of scalable investment. So what we'd like to be able to do is build out the technology platforms to do this. We want to be able to go into nature, harvest the diversity of function that's naturally existing in nature, use our fabrication platforms to basically take that DNA, synthesize these pathways into microorganisms, and then allow us to access a wide variety of different types of drug molecules. To do this, we have to basically alter the way that we think about programming biological systems so that it's not a bag of cells, but that we're actually implementing a sort of assembly plant or manufacturing plant within cells. So what we show here is the ability to actually set up specialized compartments for specific chemistries, and you're seeing enzymes being localized to certain subcellular compartments. We can actually also use our molecular computers to non-invasively detect chemical production in cells so that they will detect chemical inputs and then basically give us a signal that we can detect very easily, like a fluorescent signal. And this allows us to do rapid optimization and prototyping again in the system. So I just want to end by saying that the tools that synthetic biology is developing and really focused on are laying the groundwork for allowing us to access a wide variety of applications, from intelligent therapeutics to cost-effective drug synthesis to sustainable materials, sustainable renewable fuel sources, also looking at ways to develop sustainable agriculture, and even perhaps sustainable construction materials, and finally consumer biologics, and ultimately changing the way that we interface with nature and the world around us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christina. Now let's give a big hand for Dr. Paul Mahler. As president of Mahler International, Dr. Mahler and his team have spent almost 30 years creating the first real flying car. That's right. You dreamed for it. You wished for it. And he's going to make it for you. Bringing us the Jetsons future we've always wanted, let's welcome Dr. Paul Mahler.
On my way in today, fighting through traffic, as we all do, I was reminded of three statistics that really give us a very pessimistic view of the future. One, 92% of us get to work by road. Two, over a 10-year period, traffic increases by approximately 30%. And three, during that same 10-year period, the highway system increases by 2%. And this is a fact that's been true for some time. It'll be true in the future. That doesn't bode very well for the future, as you can imagine. What I'm going to talk about today is where we've been in options to that. The aircraft opportunity of being airborne in traffic takes us from a situation where we can't really expand on the ground to a situation where if you took every car that's in America right now on the road and put it in the air, they'd still be miles apart. So the real issue is not whether it's possible. It's a question of infrastructure, how you make this work, and two, what kind of vehicles would make it possible. When Henry Ford made this quotation back in 1940, we really didn't have a very good idea what could be possible. But what is very interesting is that within a very few years of this statement, we actually had a number of flying cars. They varied in form from the left-hand top corner where you had an airplane that was converted into a car by leaving its wings at the airport, to the one on the right at the top, which is a car that left its airplane at the airport, and the one by Molt Taylor, which was really one of the most successful. Keep in mind, these vehicles, many of them were FAA certified and okayed by the DOT. We'd never get to that today because, you know, the rules have changed. But it is amazing. These were absolutely legal in the air and on the ground. And then on the right-hand bottom, you can see the latest, which you probably heard about in the press recently, the Terra Fuga. It's pretty impressive because they brought his wings with him. But there are reasons why you don't have a flying car in your garage today. And there are three fundamental reasons. One, that you need a pilot's license, and that's a very difficult thing to get. It's a very difficult thing to keep up to date. Two, you need an airport. That's a big problem, right? Not everybody has an airport close to them. And three, if you can't get a big enough market, if it can't appeal to enough people, you're not going to get the economy of scale. If you don't get the economy of scale, you're not going to get the price down, and it's going to be limited. Those three factors are really important in the possibilities of the use of a flying car. These are what we really need to address, and one of the most important things in that is V2L. None of the cars you saw were capable of taking off vertically. And at the time they were generating these vehicles, it really wasn't possible because a vertical takeoff aircraft is called, in the world in which I work, a power lift aircraft for good reason. It really uses power to rise off the ground. And we just didn't have the power plants until fairly recently to make that possible. But now that we have a large amount of power in a small package, we can rise vertically. And that changes the whole paradigm of transportation. It needs to be somewhat roadable, but it really can't be a good car and a good airplane. It's going to be one or the other. And typically, they concentrate on a compromise between both those and pay a price for it. Three, you need an infrastructure. We call it HITS, Highway in the Sky. It's an acronym developed by NASA, which means you've got to have a system up there, a virtual highway system that's completely automated so that you're not a pilot. You're a passenger, and the vehicles deliver you from point A to point B. Because the first thing when I talk about flying cars, everybody right in their mind says, you know, I'm not going up there. It's bad enough on the ground. The idea of being up there worrying about coming at closing speeds of 600 miles an hour, because we're talking about vehicles that can travel at 300 miles an hour. You know, one of the reasons we don't travel 300 miles an hour today is because the average pilot has a hard time handling 100 miles an hour. If you're going 300 miles an hour, you've got a closing speed between two vehicles of 600. You'd never see each other before it was over. And, of course, the most important thing of all is how to integrate this highway in the sky with a set of vehicles that would make it all become possible to use a new transportation system. And if we satisfy those four first conditions there, then you really have the possibility of keeping the cost down. Economy scale comes into play. Ford certainly proved that. He paid his employees enough money that they could buy the cars, and that's really what got the whole process started, along, of course, with the highway system, which is what we need here, too. These are four vehicles that I've developed that serve different purposes. The right-hand top is a single passenger. The second on the bottom, left-hand side, is a two-passenger version. We call them Volanters. And the right-hand bottom corner is a four-passenger sky car, which is the one we've been flying. Actually, we've been flying the one up in the corner. I can show you a picture of it actually in the air. In the next picture, this is the saucer-shaped one. This is probably more of a utility, recreational, fun vehicle, and I promise you, it is fun. I've flown it. It's just great. It's a true magic carpet experience. This one is the actual sky car, which is probably much more of the vehicle that you'd be flying in the future because it's fast, it's efficient, and if we can just get enough into the marketplace, it'll be cheap. It's certainly not cheap at the moment, but then again, we don't have the highway in the sky. Without that, we really don't have universal usage. We actually have looked at other vehicles because I said earlier you really can't get a good car and a good airplane in the same package. Our Volanters, the ones I've showed you, the four pictures, they're good airplanes with some roadability. They have three wheels, so they're called a motorcycle. That allows us to avoid a lot of problems with the DOT. And then if you were dealing in the city, you could get variances so you didn't fly over 40 miles an hour. Then you can actually use it in the city. You're really only going to use this to get from your home to a vertiport, some close nearby where you get into the highway system. But we actually have looked at a car which can fly. This is a good car. It's a hybrid car, but it is not a very good flying machine. It burns a lot of fuel, and it's doing that, so it's perhaps a 50-mile range at 150 miles an hour, get you out of traffic. We haven't decided whether that really fits the future. We're looking at both options, both the Volanter and what we call the Auto Volanter, as a potential vehicle. These are the key elements that we've been able to address that we've actually done with. We've done the flying with the vehicle. We've well, you can read it all here. It's not clear from my point of view, but some of the most critical thing perhaps in our designs is that we don't have any critical moving parts. Airplanes are very complicated, and with all these moving parts, typically they describe a helicopter as 40,000 parts flying in loose formation. So it gives you some idea of the complexity of what's out there right now that takes off vertically. This is a kind of a picture of the infrastructure that's existed in the past and a projection of where it would be in the future. And it really is, these are not just idle numbers. This is, comes from actual data. We got around by canals, then we got around by railway systems. This was ultimately taken over by the highway system, which, as I said, has come to an end. We've only got about 2% per 10 years in expansion, and so the future is the airway. And you notice it climbs very rapidly because we don't have the big cost of laying down concrete and right-of-ways in a virtual highway system. So we get into it very quickly once the government commits itself to do that. You're going to ask me, well, how quickly is that going to come about? How quickly can we have that happen? I will submit the quotation of Dr. Daniel Golden, who was testifying with me before Congress on the aviation of America, and I think it's better to use his words than mine. I'm pretty prejudiced in this area, and I think his first statement there really summarizes where he thinks we're going, and I certainly concur with that. Finally, I have another slide there, but it's not shown. It's an interesting world we might live in because demographics are going to change enormously. If you have Volanders that are efficient ways to get around, you could very well get rid of your expensive home in San Francisco, take and sell it for a relatively high price if you're the first one out of town, and then go and find yourself a house on the side of a mountain somewhere, put money in the bank, and pay for your Volanter. But as I say, you better be the first one out of town. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mahler. Finally, we're excited to present Michel Maharbiz, a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at Berkeley. Michel is the mastermind behind the Cyborg Beetle, named one of Time Magazine's 50 best inventions of 2009. We'll find out what he's been up to lately, too. Tonight, we get the inside scoop on this nature-defying feat, so let's welcome Professor Michel Maharbiz.
Okay, so... The majority of this talk is movies of beetles doing weird things. So let me say a couple things. First thing is these beetles are treated according to all animal care standards. In fact, they live as long on average as beetles that have not been implanted. And after they're tested or experimented upon for a day or two, they're put into what we call the retirement home, which is a big terrarium with lots of beetles of the opposite sex and food. So they live. Now, I say this as a joke when I start this talk because I do think that this work brings up interesting ethical discussion on a variety of different levels, not just having to do with the insects themselves. So I invite you later to try to see what I think about that. But let's get going. So let's see. How do I make this go forward? Do you make this go forward? Okay, how about you be my... All right, good. So the idea behind this work was, can you take a live insect and with the right interface into its brain or its neuromuscular system, fly it around like an airplane? Okay, so can I remote control fly a live insect? Okay? Another thing I'll say is I invite everyone to learn about how insects fly. It's absolutely fantastic. There's a great book by Robert Dudley, on the mechanics of insect flight that are fantastic, and a great series of scientific articles by Mike Dickinson, who's now at Caltech, which are also fantastic. Okay, so what I mean by this is I want to, at minimum, be able to turn the thing on and off on demand. I want to be able to throttle it in flight, and I want to be able to turn it in flight. And I'll sort of define what these things mean. Usually I don't do this in 10 minutes, by the way, so we're going to see how bad this goes. The minimum system, which I'll show you in a second, required to do this, we've found, is you need a robust neural and neuromuscular interface. So we put things into the thing's brain, and we put things into the basilar muscles, the muscles responsible for steering. You need some sort of onboard processing. You need a radio. In our case, we get something like 10 meters in an office space, 50 meters outside. You need something to power it, and then you need to know where it is so you can do all this flight stuff. Next slide. Okay, so this is what they look like. By the way, there are more species of beetles than any other insect on Earth, or any other animal at all. In fact, there's more species of beetles than anything on Earth.
Beetles start as these things. These are larvae. They pupate, and then they emerge as adults and live for several months, depending on the size. And you can get beetles that are this big and beetles that are very, very small. And we've done this on several species of beetles, four or five, and it always works. So if you go up, there's a if you hit next, there's a little movie of these things emerging. And while that plays, click on that, just so you see what these things emerge after our implants. You can actually see neural stimulator electrodes sticking out of its brain when it comes out of the pupation phase. And while this plays, if you hit the arrow key again, I'll show you what these systems look like. Well, it kind of killed the movie. But this is what our early system looked like. You've got a processor, a battery. You've got electrodes into the steering muscles, and you've got electrodes that go straight into its brain, into the locomotion control part of the brain. And that's where we stimulate it and get it to do certain things. Okay, let's move on. I'm afraid that we're not going to get to the 10 minutes. The more modern systems look like this. They weigh 1.2 grams and have all of the stuff I described. It allows us to communicate with a beetle. It can also communicate back. It can do neuro and neuromuscular recording as the thing is flying. And if you hit one more, you'll see one version previous to the latest one. The latest one actually doesn't have this antenna. It's embedded in the circuit board. And this is actually what flies. And so let me tell you a little bit about how we fly these things, and then I'm just going to show you lots of movies, and it'll just be entertaining movies for the next few minutes. The way we do this is we have a room about this big instrumented with a Vicon system, which is a Hollywood-style motion capture system. And it's all sheathed in white. The beetle is tagged with infrared detectors, and what this system can do is in real time tell us everything about the beetle's orientation. We have a little flight control center with two operators, one that takes data, one that sends data, and the beetle is flown with a Wii, Nintendo Wii motion controller, okay? And I'll show you real data coming out of this thing. So move on, and let me give you an intro. So click on this one while I talk, and then we'll go across as I tell you. But start with that one. One of the earliest things we found is that if we stimulated the right part of the thing's brain, we could turn it on and off. We don't harm it. It doesn't stop doing anything else. We can actually turn flight on and turn flight off, and leave it. It'll keep going for a second. If you time the on and off fast enough, faster than its own system can respond, I can amplitude modulate the wing envelope without turning it off, which means I can throttle the thing. And I won't show you a movie real close up of this thing getting throttled, but we can throttle the way it flies. So we'll wait a second, and this will transition into going really fast. So there it's going slow, on, off, and in a second it'll go up. It'll go 1 hertz, 2 hertz, 3 hertz. And what you'll see is the thing actually never turns, and it actually sounds much better with sound, but anyway, that's fine. Don't worry about it. So what you'll see in a second, you see this thing doesn't actually ever turn off. It's sitting there going, wow, 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 wow. And in this way, I can actually throttle it as it's flying. So another remarkable thing, click on this one, is that we didn't know if the thing was on a surface and we told it to start flying. Well, the beetle might say, I have all these sensors that tell me I'm on the table. Why am I going to start flying? But in fact, these are beetles remotely being told to start. The beetle always begins flying once told to fly with essentially 100% success rate. I mean, when we tell it to start flying, it'll start flying. So I'll move on because I've got 5 minutes. We can always come back to these. So move on to the next one. Even more, no, go back. It skipped ahead for some reason. Click on that one. Even more remarkable, if you tell it to stop, even if it's in mid-flight, it will stop. So there's a start and here comes a stop. Boom. This doesn't hurt the beetle. I know it looks really weird, but it doesn't. I mean, you have to believe me. I could be lying, right? I could be going home and beheading beetles, and I was a messed up kid and wet my bed and chopped beetles' heads off, but I didn't. And the things are fine. We don't break any legs. We're always very careful. We, by the way, don't do this very often. And the other thing that you should know is, unlike these very first experiments, everything we do now is on a 1 foot cushioned floor. So these things actually don't hit solid ground very often. So okay, I think this is in slow motion. Next thing, turning. So if you click on that, we next found that by stimulating these muscles that controlled the way that the wing was building its profile, we could actually tell it to turn left and right on demand. Now, what's interesting about this is the subtlety. Left and right only has meaning because we're allowing the beetle to fly itself so that it's doing its own horizon leveling, right? If this was if I had no other position information, if the beetle didn't do this, left would have no meaning, right? If I power up the right wing when the thing's like this, it'll do something crazy. So the beetle's flying itself, and we can then bias it, and I'll show you in free flight this being done. So this is close up, so you can actually watch it. There's actually a little LED blinking if you look real close as we're sending it commands. Okay, that's probably good enough. I'm paranoid about running late. So here's a few early tries. We'll play this, and then I'll show you some data capture of one taken this week by a visitor. So the early ones. So what you see is this thing is being given a command, but of course there's no way for you to know what we're telling. We could be lying to you. Every time I turn left, I could claim, oh, I was telling it to turn left. So what happens is we have these base stations all around, and this is our older room, but we have these base stations all around that are telling us what radio commands are being sent to the beetle. And you can actually see whether we're stimulating one side or the other and trying to get it to turn one direction or the other. And this movie goes on for a little bit. Let's give it a second to, you can see it takes off, and then it started to hit a wall. And so here my students are like, turn, 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 turn. So the thing turns, he flies the other way, and so he's like left, right. And I'll show you we've done hundreds of these, and I'll show you statistical data on this so you don't think this is sort of the one shot that worked. So anyway, this reel continues for a very long time. And the one bizarre thing about this was that I never quite knew, some of these movies, there's a person that isn't my postdoc, that's my postdoc. And he always referred to that person as the operator. And one day I was like, well, who's the operator? Is it one of the underage? He goes, no, it's my wife. My wife is the only one that will sit with me. And she comes in with him, and she operated while he barks out orders. It was the funniest thing in the world. I thought it was one of his undergraduates. So anyway, this goes on and on for a while. Okay, that's fine. If you click on this, this is what we actually do with this stuff. We collect, we take the trajectories, and we tag them. See, there was a left turn issued here. There's a right turn issued there. You want to click it again? That's really weird. That movie is very long. Oh, please don't tell me this movie is acting strange. Okay. It seems to be crapping out. Okay. Well, anyway, this is a movie of a trajectory of these things. It's captured in real time as the person with the Wii. This was a visitor, actually. We gave him a Wii, told the thing to take off, and started flying it. If you move on, what we do is collect these things tagged with the commands we're giving them, and we construct models. So this is where it gets a little more than just showing you movies. Okay, I've run over time. Okay, I'm going to go really fast. I'll be done. So we construct models of what this thing is doing, and we wrap control around them. So if you go on ahead, let me show you. I'll leave you with a movie, and I'll talk through it. So if you click on this, this is from Peter Abillo, who's a collaborator. What this is a helicopter this big that's being flown completely autonomously by an AI program. That AI program watched one of the world's best helicopter flyers for an hour and could pull this off. Nobody's flying this except the computer. The reason you can do this is the computer's taking information, including wind and all the things that the helicopter's experiencing, and wrapping control around it. We're going to wrap control around the beetle. We're in the process of doing this right now, where there's an AI that essentially watches this thing, and as it's doing these little turns, it can adjust and get very complex behavior out of the flight of these beetles. So where we're going is basically the same thing that's being done with this helicopter being done on a small beetle in our flight control room. I know, I got 30 seconds. All right, let's skip this. This is what I said. And the other place we're going is we are pretty sure within 12 months we'll have a fly. We can drop all of this into a very, very small CMOS technology and run a fly this way. So I'll leave you with that probably extremely disconcerting thought. And I'll stop there, and you guys can ask me questions later, I guess.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I'll ask all the speakers to come up and sit by your name, or sit by someone else's name, but you should probably sit by your own name. That'd be better. And while they do that, let's give them all a big round of applause for these six amazing individuals. And now I will welcome you to the discussion portion of tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club presented by Inforum. And remember that you can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Inforum, was it something I said, guys? Anything? No. commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. And we're going to bring you all of these jaw droppers together now for a short dialogue followed by your audience questions. And we'll let you guys drive how many questions you want to hear from me versus how many you want yourself. So if you do have questions in a few minutes here, line up behind the mics and we'll get to them. And again, I'm Julie Crable, CEO of Inner Circle Labs, and tonight's moderator. So let's get the panel underway.
Everyone is speechless.
Exactly. I get to bang this three times. That's part of the deal. So there you go. So first question. Now, Jeff, Michelle, and Sebastian, could you guys get together and create an AI-driven card-counting beetle? And if you could, would that be legal or illegal, Jeff?
I think it'd be illegal.
Yeah.
You'd be using a computer. It's an outside device.
Interesting.
The reason card counting is legal is you're just using your brain.
Okay.
So
if we just let the beetle think for itself without the AI from Sebastian.
The beetle has to just, we have to train the beetle, and the beetle can't have a computer in its
okay.
mind.
Okay, that's a whole nother layer of abstraction.
But I mean, it'd be really easy to do it because I could train anyone in this room to card count.
Okay, so we should get a beetle. Can we get a beetle for that, Michelle, do you think?
Sure.
Okay.
I'd be happy to.
Awesome.
Contribute Beatles for this.
Now, there are a lot of different threads of conversation going on here, so I think that one thing that came up that was really interesting was Jonathan's idea of absurdity. How can we all bring a little bit more absurdity to the way that we think and the way that we work across the board for anyone? You know, has absurdity or kind of off-the-wall creative thinking gone into what you've done and when and where in your process?
Well, in my case, I think people think that many times what I'm doing is pretty absurd. Start with just simply the flying car is something we've all imagined for a long time, and it just seems like something beyond our grasp. So I'm obviously out on the edge of people's belief in what can happen.
Nice. Anyone else?
Well, I mean, I think that in general, the book I wrote, people think is a little bit absurd that you can learn business lessons from a casino or from quote-unquote gambling. And then when people read it, I think they understand that so much of what we did wasn't gambling at all. What was interesting was during the time that I was a professional card counter, I was 21 years old, but I was also working on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange as a trader. And what I was doing there was much more like gambling. And then what I was doing in the casino was not really gambling at all. So it's like what you guys do in the markets is much more like gambling. What we were doing in the casinos wasn't. But my parents couldn't really tell people at cocktail parties that I was a professional card counter, so I had to keep this day job to throw them off.
Right.
I should maybe say that I never really set out to be absurd, as strange as it may sound. I think that I just have a very literal mind, a certain naivete about the world. And so I just follow whatever comes to me, and it ends up people start laughing. And, well, they should. I start laughing as well. Because I think that there is something that ends up being funny when you follow common sense and you let various strains of common sense, various assumptions that we have, all collide with each other, and all the various inconsistencies start to play off each other in incredibly strange and absurd ways.
And in terms of other jaw-dropping stuff, what have you guys learned from other industries that you've brought to bear for your work or other parts of the world, other businesses, whatever it might be? And are there any things that you think that other industries should try to take from you and what you've been working on?
I can take this. The most remarkable thing to me has been the last 10 years have brought us about as much innovation as the previous 90 years. Which have brought about as much innovation as the previous 500 years in terms of technology. It's quite amazing how the pace of technology is accelerating. What that teaches me is that many of the things that you smile about today as absurd might actually be reality tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And kind of along the lines of that, I mean, blackjack was introduced in casinos in the 1930s, and then card counting wasn't discovered until the 1960s. And, you know, part of the reason that it wasn't discovered was because there weren't computers in the 1930s to run the simulations that they did in the 1960s. But I think in a lot of ways that's what's happening in society right now. You know, there's been a long time where people are kind of ignoring information that they could be using to make better decisions. And they're kind of just making the same decisions over and over again that they did. You know, in my book I talk a lot about sports and how sports teams, you know, in general, ignore information to make the decisions, and then in business, they're doing the same thing.
Politicians.
So it's like, what's that?
Politicians.
Yeah. So it's like people. Yeah, and really, I mean, every time you make a decision, I mean, it's like for the last, you know, whatever years, people have been making it one way, and they don't realize that they could be making better decisions if they started using technology better, or data better, or information better. And there's just this incredible, you know, stubbornness or reluctance to try to quote unquote use gut and intuition to make decisions when, you know, again, in my book, there's a chapter called the brain cells in your stomach, because, I mean, the last time I checked, there weren't any brain cells in your stomach. So,
let's take a few questions from the audience. You have a question, and you've been standing so patiently. Go ahead.
I do. My question is for Dr. Strom and Mueller. Both of you presented alternative ways to increase efficiency of traffic flow. So I was hoping that both of you could comment on the other's ideas and some pros and cons about that. And then, Dr. Mueller, I would like to know what fuel, if it's gasoline or would be some other heavier fuel like jet fuel, and what miles per gallon of gas, effective gasoline, you would get.
The fuel we use is ethanol. It's the first choice. We've always used that in our flights, although we've done some flying with methanol. And as I showed on my slide, we've been able to demonstrate 100 passenger miles per gallon. which is, of course, in the vehicle about 25 miles per gallon. But one of the things you can do with a flying car is you can have a one-passenger flying car, two-passenger, three-passenger, four-passenger. So you can really achieve that. In your automobile, you get about 1.2 passenger miles if the car is used very little beyond one person. And by addressing it that way with one or two or three or four passenger vehicles, and in this case, of course, you don't have a one-passenger vehicle because you're worried about being hit by a five-passenger vehicle. And so you really aren't willing to get in that little dinky car. But when you're an aircraft going 300 miles an hour, it doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference whether you hit the other guy with five passengers or one passenger. It's all over for you. So if you've got a controlled airspace, you might as well use it, and you can use it to go fast, and you can use it very efficiently. So 100 passenger miles per gallon has been demonstrated in our analysis.
Yes, since we ask about each other's technology, I'm actually a big fan of the idea of getting up in the air for many reasons that were mentioned. I think there's some other interesting changes that are really significant. I think the most important one is actually electric. I think electric is more important for aircraft and for flight than it is for the ground transportation. Reason being that electric affords us to be very quiet, and being quiet means that you can basically take over your neighborhood and not be more noisy than, say, a regular lawnmower, which is very different from today's watercraft that are insanely noisy. It also provides a layer of safety. If you take today's rotorcraft, the blades are held together by something called a Jesus bolt, and it shows a sign of faith that you have to into flying. It's basically called faith-based flying. If you go to electric, it's really easy to make your propulsion system distributed, so you have many different fans, and if one or two of them fail, it's not a big deal. I think these things will really change transportation. The reason why I work on cars is much more realistic right now than inventing aircraft. Many more things have to happen for us to go in the air, but I'm a firm believer it's going to happen.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is also a question for Dr. Mueller. I'm curious if you've ever thought about designing unmanned cars maybe for the purpose of, like, delivery vehicles. Seems like there are a lot less safety issues, and there are a lot of reasons for delivering things short distances and getting things quicker.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, the flying car that we propose would be one where you get it in the vehicle, you drive a few blocks to a vertiport, take off, and at that point you're just coding your destination, and you're delivered much like a package. So it could be either with a human on board as a package or your package. It's perfectly safe. I mean, even a drunk's going to arrive safely, but he might end up at the wrong destination. So it's a world which is already there. I mean, today airliners can take off from point A to point B without the pilots being involved. Of course, we're not going to go along with that for the moment, but that infrastructure is there for that to happen. It's certainly going to be possible to use that same infrastructure expanded for us to get around on a personal level.
All right. Thank you.
We have continually heard that there is not a whole lot of money for research in our country.
Yes.
But each of the projects I have heard you talk about must take an enormous amount of resources. So my question is, where do you find them now?
Yeah, so, whose money are you guys spending?
Who wants to take that one? Because I can talk about that for an hour and a half.
I can too.
We are irresponsible with the use of resources in so many ways in this country. One is the future of education, and one is research. A lot of wealth that we have today goes back to investments that were made about 30, 40 years ago. We all brag and pride ourselves of innovation like internet, and these are investments that are directly traceable to stuff that was invested 30 or 40 years ago. I think our nation has flipped over into one where we don't appreciate education and long-term investments in research as much anymore. It's a real concern.
Yeah. You didn't answer the question, where do you get your research money?
Yeah. Well, do you want to answer where you get your research money from, or am I going to? So I think that, so this is speaking only for myself. I showed you this stuff, and I'm a professor at Berkeley, and I love being there and so on. But I'm on industrial leave right now as a VP of an energy company, product development energy company. And I think that there is an interesting looming problem with the amount of effort that we as PIs have to make to collect the funds required to do the work that we want to do if we really want it to be, far out. If you look 30, 40 years ago, the amount of work that a professor had to do to obtain the money that he or she needed to get stuff going is far less than what we do. We become traveling salesman, really. And the more that that continues, the more there will be a brain drain into the commercial sector and away from the really far-out stuff like what I got to do in academia, because if I'm a young person, I start to think, well, do I really want to do what this guy's doing, or I'm just going to go work in the private sector? So right now, in engineering, the bulk of the money, unless you're doing engineering that relates to medical problems, comes from the Department of Defense. That's the actual answer. So the DOD funds almost, and this isn't creepy. It's just, they fund all sorts of stuff that if they didn't fund, none of you would be sitting on the chairs that you're sitting and breathing the air you're breathing and going to work in the vehicles you go work. It's by far benign stuff, but it is the DOD. So
I keep my costs low. I am serious in saying this. To genetically engineer God, or at least to run the first two pilot studies, most of the equipment came from flea markets. A few things came off of eBay, and I think the total cost was under $100. And this is not in any way to denigrate other research, but I do think that it is possible to undertake serious experiments in how we think about the world and how we live in it, very inexpensively, and for all of us to do so, for each of us to do so. There's the great thing about being an artist is that, you know, everyone is an artist, we've been told, since the 1960s, and I think that it's even more so today. Anyone can undertake any of these sorts of thought experiments and can explore the world in that way.
Wait, you didn't want to denigrate other attempts, but have there been other attempts to bioengineer God?
There have not been. Actually, the attempt that I made, though, I should say that it did have a bit of funding from UC Berkeley. The fruit flies that I used came from Tom Klein's lab there and were raised for me at taxpayer expense. So I guess I lied.
Go ahead.
So I had two questions. First, if you have an inspiration, what is it? What's it that keeps you inspired? And how do you deal with criticism in others, right? When you tell your ideas to somebody else, they're skeptical about it. How do you deal with that?
So how do you deal with skepticism, and how do you keep yourself inspired?
Skeptics are just wrong.
That's a good way. Works. Anyone else? How do you stay inspired and deal with skeptics?
I can try. I draw my inspiration from the source of many innovators' draw inspiration, which is just discomfort with the current status quo. Just looking out what's wrong with the world. And there's so many things that are wrong about the world. I mean, you can become a skeptic and just sit there and complain about it, or you can try to do something and fix it. So I take great pride in my attempts to fix things, even though I often don't succeed. Skeptics, especially in Germany, is full of skeptics, turns out. The only reason why I'm actually here is because America doesn't have any skeptics, as many as Germany. Often they have a good point, but often I also just challenge them to think a step further and not just bitch about it, but fix it. And many skeptics become very quiet when you do this. I think at the end of the day, we want the same thing. It's just the method at which we approach these things are different.
Okay. Next question, unless anyone else wants to answer. Go ahead.
A quick comment to Dr. Mahler. How roadable does your vehicle have to be? I was a private pilot for 30 years. My biggest issue was getting from the airport of destination to the actual doorway where I was going. If you can take this vehicle and land it very close, then it doesn't have to be very roadable to get from where you set it down on the terrain to what your ultimate destination. So think about that.
Yes, that's a good question. As I said earlier, you do certain things in your design that ease that problem for you. First, we use three wheels. Makes us a motorcycle in many states, which helps a lot, because if you can avoid the DOT, you've got one step to the front on that process. Secondly, in many cases, you would have a local variance that would keep you at 40 miles an hour or something like that, maybe 25 even, which would allow you to get there. Because as you say, in the future, there's going to be vertiports fairly closely located in most cities. It doesn't take very much when you take them off vertically. You can at some point take off from your house, but it's going to be a number of years because we've got to solve some sound problems before that's going to happen. But yes, you can have just a modest roadability. Not you don't have to theoretically protect yourself for crashes, which is important from the DOT, but you know, you have to worry about that yourself when you're driving the vehicle.
Well, and that leads to my next issue, which is the control systems. And Michelle, your presentation was really interesting. From what I understand, when I was flying my Bonanza, I had to figure out what I wanted the airplane to do and then figure out how to tell it to do it. Current military aircraft like the Stealths, the pilot tells it with a joystick what it wants the plane to do. The plane's control system figure out how. Is the next evolution some technology wired into the human brain where you think? I mean, you're doing it with bugs, right?
Yeah.
Where you think what you want it to do, and maybe Sebastian and Paul can get together and figure out, you know, what's your prediction about the ability to control your mechanisms with thought processes rather than mechanical inputs?
Well, I'll say I don't think you want to interface with the human brain, because our control systems, the stuff that, you know, these guys work on, and Peter Abiel, are fabulous, right? I mean, there are things we do better than nature. That's just, it's hard to dispute that. And so I wouldn't want a human brain running a vehicle. I would want the incredibly good computer systems running it and the human brain just inputting local or global high-level information. Like, I want to get to grandma's house.
Yeah, you tell it the what, it figures out how.
Yeah, but think about it. You don't run your – so this is an interesting point. Think your iPhone, right? Your iPhone does all this stuff, right, that you frankly have no hope of ever understanding, really. I mean, and I don't mean because I do. I mean just because there's incredibly complex stuff in a cell phone that took dozens and hundreds of people to figure out. You don't sit there and try to tell it how to GPS talk to the radio. You just tell it, give me whatever – where's McDonald's or whatever, right? And the thing figures it out. That's essentially the world we live in now. You know, the brain is good for certain things. I would argue it's probably not good for wiring into a vehicle. But anyway.
Maybe. Well, no, and this is a great conversation that we can continue during the reception. So in closing, I want to ask one last question for each of the panelists. If you could give me your 20-second, less than a sentence, as tight as possible, what is your solution to change the world? Just rattle them out.
You want me to start?
Go ahead.
I think this has been said before. I think if we compelled everyone to live in another country more than three boundaries away and live on the median income for a year, I think things would be very different.
Nice. Anyone else?
Well, I think I've spoken to that tonight, really, when I talked about what I'm doing. I would be very excited about the ability to be that mobile, to be as mobile as a hummingbird and go where you want, when you want, in an environment free from the ground transportation.
I think, you know, it's important that, sort of getting back to some of the comments that were made during the discussion, that we not be afraid to be wrong, that we sort of keep ourselves open to dreaming, and that we continue learning throughout our lifetime.
Be curious.
I want more girls in science and engineering.
I want no more synchronous communication through phones.
I like that. Now let's give a hand to our six jaw droppers tonight. And please join us for the reception. And now this meeting of Inform of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.